funky horse, I love his giant hose. War horse. Out on the battlefield, he shows his funky mode. Oh, yeah.
War horse.
A clip, clip, clappity clue.
A war horse, yeah.
Chargy gallopy goo, oh yeah. Clip, clap, a clip, clip, clap. A clip, clip, clap, the clue. Oh yeah. Clip, clap, a war horse, baby. A war horse, baby, the boo. Oh yeah, now. Clip, clip, clap, war horse, baby. A war horse, baby, boo. A war horse, baby, war horse, baby. Chargy gallopy goo, oh yeah, now.
Hello and welcome to The Last Line Between Journalistic Integrity and Whatever It Is We Do, Film Book Cast, the official podcast of filmbook.com. My name is Mike Smith. Joining me, as always, is a man who has always wanted to take part in a small rebellion.
Mike DiCrescia.
How you doing today, Mike?
I am feeling quite rebellious, actually.
That's good. You're feeling rebellious. You're feeling, I don't even know where I was going with that.
Yeah. I'm ready to cast off the shackles of podcasts.
Oppression.
And just keep making a podcast, I guess. No, nope.
That's good.
Didn't think that one all the
way
through.
That's a good mindset to be in. We are both real tired today, I think is what's happening.
This will be a good one.
If you've never listened to Film Bookcast before, usually we're not much better than what that just was. But first we start with some film news, and then we move on into some discussions where Mike and I each discuss whatever piece of media we've been consuming lately. And then after that, we move on into our featured review. This week, we are discussing the new film from director Steven Spielberg and a recent Oscar nominee for Best Picture, The Post. Are you excited to take The Post, Mike?
Yeah, way to spoil that it's nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah, well, I guess we are talking about the Oscar nominations in film news in a few minutes. But I don't think it's a spoiler to say that it is.
Because it happened in real life 2 days ago?
Yeah, that, and also because it was kind of a foregone conclusion. It's the Spielberg historical drama starring Tom Hanks and Meryl Streep. I'm surprised it hasn't already swept the Oscars.
They canceled the Oscars this year, actually, and just gave them all to this movie.
Exactly, yeah. If Daniel Day-Lewis was in this instead of Phantom Thread, boom. Like,
game over.
Like they would just stop the Oscars altogether. We would never have another Oscars ceremony again. They would be renamed the Post Awards. And they would go to the Post every year.
Oh, my God.
All right, now this podcast is back on track. Mike, let's get into some film news.
Hi, it's time for...
What?
It's time for film news here on Film Bookcast. Now, Mike, we've got a lot of superhero news to get through. Here's the thing. It's been a little while since we've recorded a full traditional episode of Film Bookcast. We did our top 10 a couple of weeks ago, and before that we did our Star Wars review. So it's been about a month since a traditional Film Bookcast episode.
Yeah, we haven't talked about Marvel in a long time.
So long, unless you count you putting Thor Ragnarok on your top 10 list.
Don't ruin this.
And also, I was talking about what movies were coming out in the Marvel universe in 2018 in that episode as well. But we haven't talked about news recently. And there are a couple of developing superhero stories I wanted to bring up, just a couple of minor things. First off is that Tim Miller, director of Deadpool, and who's currently working on Terminator 6, is developing a Kitty Pryde movie for whatever is left between Fox and Marvel. I don't know what the status of things are over there. I don't know how they can continue to put movies in development without Disney overhead. I really don't understand how this works, but if it happens, like, that'd be kind of cool, right?
Like, sure, I guess. They're owned by the same company now, so fuck it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious how this whole Disney, Marvel, Fox situation is going to pan out, like if it's going to result in more X-Men Fox movies, because that's what Kitty Pryde is under. She's under the X-Men banner. Or if this is going to be integrated into the Marvel Universe somehow, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. But Kitty Pryde is one of my all-time favorite Marvel characters, so I would be so down for her to get a solo movie. She's been involved with a lot of my favorite work. I mean, she was part of a big part of Astonishing X-Men, which is the run that Joss Whedon wrote in the mid-2000s. And she's the exact character that Joss Whedon writes so well. And obviously, Joss Whedon's working on Batgirl right now, and I assume he's going to pretty much take what he did with Kitty Pryde and do that with Batgirl. But even so, I think there's a lot of good stuff to be done with Kitty Pryde. I know she's had a romantic relationship with Colossus in the comics, and of course he's in the Deadpool movies now. She's also been involved with Peter Quill from Guardians of the Galaxy, so like maybe they could just throw her in there. Like, who knows? There's a lot you can do with Kitty Pryde, and I'm assuming this will not involve Ellen Page, who has played Kitty Pryde in the other movies.
Right.
And very small roles. Like, she's in X-Men 3 and Days of Future Past, and they're basically like glorified cameos.
All right, Logan, I need you to clear your head and to stay as calm as possible.
What do you mean?
If your mind gets rocky, it'll be harder for me to hold you, and you could start to slip between past and future.
What if I need to get a little rocky?
Think peaceful thoughts?
Peaceful thoughts.
You have any good news?
Well, I mean, you don't really age, so you'll pretty much look the same.
So I would very much be excited for the extended Kitty Pryde cinematic universe, or whatever. Whatever it is you want to call it. It'd be kind of a bummer if Ellen Page isn't doing it, but she might be a little too old for the role now. Kitty Pryde kind of calls for, like, teenager, early 20s kind of character, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm interested in what this could be. I don't know. I haven't read a whole lot of X-Men or anything like that, so I don't have particular affection for the character, but I know she is a very popular one.
Yeah.
And I know it's your boy, your favorite director, coming in big.
Tim Miller?
I'm lying. That's a lie.
Yeah, I have said in the past that Tim. I think Tim Miller's fine. I got nothing against him. Yeah. But for like when he was leaving Deadpool and got replaced on Deadpool 2, people were acting like he was like, you know, the second coming of Jesus. Like he,
yeah,
he, you know, he's the next Spielberg, is what he.
His artistic vision, though.
Yeah, and I didn't get that. I didn't get that from him with Deadpool. That's the only movie he's ever directed, so I can't really say for sure. But I think if this Kitty Pryde movie ever does happen, and I don't think it actually will, I'm throwing that out there right now. I think if it does happen, it'll be a while, because he is working on Terminator 6 right now, and that seems like it has much more of a go-ahead than Kitty Pryde does at the moment.
Yeah.
But in other X-Men related news, Mike, I guess we have to retract a story that happened about 2 or 3 months ago. In like October of this podcast, we reported that Gore Verbinski is a director who is now attached to direct Gambit. No longer. He's not doing that anymore.
R.I.P.
Yeah, and that's a bummer. I mean, Gore Verbinski is a really exciting director. He's one I'm a big fan of. And Gambit's a project that, you know, has been kind of in development hell for a long time. That he is now the third director to leave that project after Rupert Wyatt, who did Rise of the Planet of the Apes. He was supposed to make Gambit. And Doug Liman, who made, you know, Bourne Identity, Edge of Tomorrow. He was supposed to make Gambit. Didn't happen. So now Gore Verbinski was on it for like 2 months and is out again.
What if it turns out that Channing Tatum is just the worst? That'd be so sad.
That would be kind of sad. That would be kind of a bummer. And so because of that, Gambit was supposed to come out in February 2019. And now it's being pushed to May 2019. And it's not going to make that date either. I don't know why they're pretending. Do they not know that it has no director? Is that...
I don't think they caught on yet.
Anyway, yes. And Fox actually shuffled around a couple of their release dates. So Gambit's been pushed to May 2019. Deadpool 2 actually got pushed up a couple of weeks. It was supposed to come out in June of this year. It's now coming out in May. And it's sandwiched right between Avengers Infinity War and Solo, A Star Wars Story.
Which we all know isn't happening either.
Yeah, that's true. Disney doesn't want you to know that Solo exists, but...
Yeah.
But if it does indeed exist, that release date is still there. And I don't think they're backing out of it now. It's you know, 3 months away. Although based on what the next movie we'll talk about is, maybe they can. But it's just weird to me that like they would sandwich Deadpool so close in between those two massive movies. I mean,
yes,
like, I don't think Solo will do as well as the other Star Wars movies have done. Partially because I feel like it has much lower profile. Partially because of the release date. It's not hitting that December release date where it's going to make all the money. And it's also like a recasting of an iconic role. Like it's going to be, I think, a tough sell for audiences. But even so, I think putting Deadpool 2 up, right, I think it's the week before Solo it's opening, but it's like the week after Avengers or something like that. Like it's something insane. It's right in between those two. And it's like, it feels like you're setting yourself up for failure. I think Deadpool 2 will still be a hit. It'll still make money, but like everybody is going to see Avengers. Everybody and their mother and their grandmother and they're going to grave rob their great grandmother and take her to the theater too. Like it's you know, and it's everyone's going to see Avengers, and Deadpool's got that R rating, you know, and that's going to cut into some of the audience at least. Right. Like has to.
Yeah. It feels really weird to, like you said, like set themselves up to fail by moving it into that that slot because there's no way. It's 1 week. Everyone that didn't get an advanced ticket to the first weekend is going to go to the second weekend.
Yeah.
And they're not going to pick Deadpool over Avengers. Like, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. It might be 2 weeks, but even so, it's just, I don't know. I don't know, man. It just feels like, a very crammed May. And then like to follow it up with Star Wars the week after, like most people, like I'm going to go see all these movies. But like most people don't go to the movies every weekend. You know, most people go a couple times a year, you know, that's the reality of it. And so they either pick their movies very carefully or they don't give a shit and they just pick like whatever people are going to. Right. So,
yeah.
And May will be big. There's a new Avengers and a new Star Wars movie coming out in the same month. You really think Deadpool can
compete?
I admire the confidence.
Bold strategy, Kyle.
I think they are banking on the idea that Solo won't be as big as other Star Wars movies and that Deadpool can pull in that box office instead. So we'll see what happens. But I think that 2 weeks that it's being pushed up like 2 weeks. I think that 2 weeks can make a whole lot of difference. And the other Fox movie that was supposed to come out this year, Mike, New Mutants, it was supposed to be released in April of this year, is now being released in February of 2019.
So RIP that, I guess.
Yeah.
That hurts. That feels weird. That
feels like a bad sign. I think, that's the one that's sort of being marketed as a horror movie. The official reason they're saying it got delayed is because they want to make it scarier. But they're also committing to a PG-13 rating for that one, it sounds like. So it's like, I just don't know.
And when did they move it to? When April 2019?
February 2019. A full 10-month delay. You know, is not unprecedented. It's happened before. I remember there was a Harry Potter movie that got delayed pretty close to its release date. I think it was Half-Blood Prince was supposed to come out in, like, November 2009, or I think November 2008. And it ended up getting pushed, like, July 2009, right? Something like that.
Right.
And that was, like, a couple months before it was supposed to come out. And then I remember G.I. Joe Retaliation was another one where I'm just saying.
It's happened. Okay.
Yeah. I think that was supposed to come out in like summer of 2012 or something. And the trailer was out and everything. And it ended up getting delayed until like March 2013. You know, it happens. It does happen. But it's very rare that something like that happens. And it's usually not a great sign. And G.I. Joe Retaliation, I kind of like. I think it's kind of fun. And that Harry Potter movie is one of the better Harry Potter movies. So that delay ended up working for it. Even so, I just feel like this, and there is a trailer for New Mutants out. The trailer's been out for a couple of months now, and now I guess it's just not going to play for a long time. It's just going to sit there on YouTube or whatever. And
did you know baby rattlesnakes are more dangerous than adult ones? They haven't learned how to control how much venom they secrete. All of you are dangerous. That's why you're here.
So we'll see what happens with New Mutants. Good news is X-Men Dark Phoenix is still right on schedule.
Oh, man. I was nervous for a second.
November 2018, the one everyone's looking forward to the most. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's what's going on in the X-Men universe. And then finally got one last bit of superhero news. John Francis Daly and Jonathan Goldstein are the new directors attached to The Flash / Flashpoint, or whatever it's going to be called for DC. And much like Gambit, this is a superhero movie that has just cycled through a bunch of directors at this point. They are the third ones to be attached to this thing. Seth Graham Smith was supposed to direct it at first, and then Rick Famuyiwa, the director of Dope, was attached to this, and now it's these guys. And these guys have been fairly successful screenwriters. They were two of the writers on Spider-Man Homecoming. They wrote and directed the Vacation reboot with Ed Helms, which is, I think, is their only other directorial credit. They directed the upcoming movie Game Night, which I've seen trailers for and looks kind of funny. They're comedy people. John Francis Daly was actually, if you ever watched Freaks and Geeks, he was Sam Weir, the kid on that show. And did you ever watch Freaks and Geeks, Mike? I see you like physically looking. Linda Cardellini's brother.
Okay, got it.
He's like the dorky little kid in that show, and so it's kind of fun that like he grew up to be a Hollywood screenwriter. I think that's neat.
Yeah. But,
like,
where's Cindy liked me? She likes you. Yeah, like a friend. Ooh, that's the worst. I don't need another friend. I already have two. I mean, how many more friends does a guy need?
But anyway, yeah, I mean, these guys are fine, I'm sure. It's weird. Apparently, they actually offered this to Ben Affleck to direct.
Oh, boy.
Which is interesting.
That would have been great if he took that and he left the Batman to go make the Flash movie.
I'm going to leave the Batman and stop playing Batman, but I'll go and I'll go direct the Flash. That's fine.
I'll direct it. It's fine.
Yeah, so I feel like the fact that they offered it to him might mean that he might be appearing in this Flash movie, but we really don't know what's going on with Batman at this point. You know, because this one's called Flashpoint, so they could use this to, like, maybe be an exit for Ben Affleck's Batman and, like, recast him with another role or something.
Oh, my
recast
God. They're going to do a timeline thing and reboot the universe three movies in.
Yeah, and we've said before, if there's anything the Flash respects, it's timelines. So
the most sacred thing in all Flash stories. But really, we have to get over the hump of Aquaman first before we know about anything else.
I guess that's true, yeah. And Aquaman's not hitting until December of this year. And that, I mean, that is James Wan, you're right. And so I am kind of tentatively excited for that. I think James Wan's a very good filmmaker. The DC Universe, not in great shape, but it does have Wonder Woman, and it does have the potential for a James Wan Aquaman, a potential Matt Reeves Batman, a Joss Whedon Batgirl. There's good stuff on the horizon if they can just do it. Like, if they can just get it right.
If they can survive long enough to get there.
Exactly. Anyway, so I think that wraps up our superhero movie news for today, Mike. We got a lot of other stuff to get to. Also wanted to bring up that the Starz, the premium cable network, is developing a John Wick TV series.
But my only question is why?
Are you not on board for a John Wick show? Because I'm kind of into it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I think I read somewhere that it's going to be about the Continental Hotel, which is the most interesting part of the John Wick.
I feel like if you're going to make a John Wick TV show, that's the obvious route to go. It's going to be called The Continental.
Okay.
And it's going to be exploring the world of the John Wick films in more detail. So assuming it's about some people in the Continental, supposedly rumor is Keanu Reeves might make an appearance on the show.
Oh, God.
Which, you know, I'm always down for more Keanu and John Wick. That's not
a problem. That would actually be really cool if he just kind of, like, is this, like, specter through the show that just kind of, like, shows up every now and then and is not really, you know, not really part of the show.
Right. I wouldn't expect him to be the star. He's not like, it's not like Ash vs. Evil Dead where Bruce Campbell is, like, you know, the main character on that show.
Yeah.
I would expect Keanu Reeves to maybe pop up in, like, the pilot and, like, maybe pop up every once in a while, possibly. But I think that there's a lot of potential for this show. The world building in the John Wick series has been spectacular. And so, you know, I'd be into it. And if there's, like, cool core, like, if it's the same people making it, like, or similar people making it, like, the choreography, like, as long as you got good fight choreography, like, you're halfway there. With this John Wick TV show. So I just wanted to bring that up. So I think it's kind of neat. I don't have Starz anymore, though. I'm very upset about that. Optimum canceled my Starz subscription. Blue, did you hear about this?
Yes.
Yeah. Were you affected by this change, Mike, at all? Or?
No, I don't have Optimum, so I'm not being extorted or whatever the hell they're doing.
Yeah. No, Optimum and Starz are like a disagreement or something. I think Starz wanted to charge Optimum more money to use their channels or something. Optimum didn't go for it or whatever. I don't know what happened. Point is, I don't have Starz or Encore anymore, and it sucks.
The struggle.
Because Ash vs. Evil Dead comes back in like 2 months, and I need to find a way to watch it. I'll probably get the Starz app on Amazon or something, but it's, you know, I would rather just not have to pay the extra dollars. That's basically all it is. But anyway, wanted to bring that up. And then we got some award stuff we need to get to, Mike. First off, before we get into the Oscar nominations, we never really got a chance to talk about the Golden Globes, which happened a couple of weeks ago. And I'm assuming you didn't watch them.
Correct.
Okay. So we'll go through them relatively fast. I thought it was a relatively boring show. It wasn't great. The awards all went to, I liked all the awards that they were given. Like, I think everybody who won was like somebody I can get behind pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was as an award show, it kind of just moved along. There was no real comedic bits outside of Seth Meyers' opening monologue, which had some funny stuff in there. But what really set this award show apart, I thought, it had a sense of energy and change in the room, you know, associated with the hashtag MeToo movement and the Time's Up movement. There's been a lot of that in the Hollywood industry over the past few months. And the Golden Globes was kind of the, you could feel it in the room there. And especially that's exemplified in Oprah Winfrey's big speech. Oprah Winfrey got a Lifetime Achievement Award at the Golden Globes, the Cecil B. DeMille Award, which they give every year. This year it went to Oprah, and she had this really fantastic speech. Got trending on Twitter. People were talking about it. Like, as soon as that speech ended, people were joking that Oprah should run for president and all that stuff. And that's a little extreme. Don't go there.
She confirmed actually today she would not do it. So
yeah, I never really thought she would. You know,
no, but that she had to say it is scary.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. I never really thought she would, but at the same time, like, I could see it as a possibility because I don't even know what's going on in the world anymore. Nothing makes sense. Why not? But the, anyway, as far as the awards go, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri won Best Drama, even though it's a dark comedy. Lady Bird won for comedy. And then Guillermo del Toro won Best Director. And he gave a great, very del Toro-y speech. It was great. He was, you know, talking to the, like, the music started playing, and he was like, guys, I've waited, like, 25 years to win this. I'm going to keep talking and, like, all that stuff. And he's just talking about, his, like, the monsters that he used to play with when he was a kid. And he ended with, like, me and my monsters, we thank you for this. And I was like, fuck yeah, Guillermo del Toro. Like,
you're welcome.
Yeah, like, I'm so happy for him, man. Like, he's getting a lot of recognition this award season. I'm just so stoked about that.
Because as directors, these things are not just entries in a filmography. We have made a deal with a particularly inefficient devil that trades 3 years of our lives for one entry on IMDb. And these things are biography, and they are life. And I want to thank the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, Fox Searchlight, and I wouldn't be here. Lower the music, guys. One second. It's taken 25 years. Give me a minute. Give me a minute. I wouldn't be here without my cast, my crew, and I want to mention a few fantastic women sitting at this table. Sharon, Nancy, Octavia, Sally, Kimmy, and Vanessa, without whom I wouldn't be here. I thank you. My monsters thank you. And somewhere, Lon Chaney is smiling upon all of us. Thank you very much.
Other than that, you know, they're the big moments. Oprah's speech, actually right before the Best Director category was announced, Natalie Portman was presenting, and this got a lot of press where Natalie Portman kind of called out the lack of female directors in that category, because a lot of people were saying, well, Greta Gerwig should have been nominated for Best Director, especially since Lady Bird won Best Comedy. It's like, so this is the best movie of the year, but the director had nothing to do with it, or like, or what, you know, so there was that. And then there was the James Franco of it all, which was kind of a bummer. You know, I don't know if you, I mean, I don't know if you've seen this. He's been one of the people outed for sexual harassment. The stories about him have not been great. And that happened right after the Golden Globes. He won,
I think, the next day, maybe?
Yeah, well, he won for Best Actor in a Comedy for a Disaster Artist. And it was, I mean, it's kind of funny. Tommy Wiseau was there, and he invited Tommy up on the stage. And then Tommy went to go grab the mic, and James Franco just, like kind of swatted him away.
Yeah, he, like, boxed him out.
Yeah. Which, I mean, I think that's fine because Tommy Wiseau would just go off. Like, I don't need Tommy Wiseau to be making speeches at my award shows. That's fine. But yeah, James Franco was wearing a Time's Up pin, and you know, the next day, like, a bunch of allegations against him came out, and that was very unfortunate. And I think that had an impact, at least in terms of the awards recognition of the Disaster Artist. A lot of the awards henceforth haven't really been as favorable to it. He was a heavy favorite to be nominated for Best Actor at the Oscars, and was not. He was not nominated, and I think that definitely had something to do with it. And he was actually, I mean, he was at the SAG Awards, which were a week ago, 2 weeks ago. And it was interesting because Aziz Ansari was also nominated for an award there, and he's also kind of been embroiled in a controversy that isn't as that one's a little weirder. The Aziz Ansari one.
Yeah. No, I read some of it.
Yeah, that one has a lot of people divided about what it actually is, but the James Franco one is pretty open and shut. But it was weird because the SAG Awards, Aziz Ansari was nominated for Master of None, didn't show up, and he just didn't go. James Franco, he was there.
James Franco doesn't give a fuck.
Yeah. So yeah, very weird. But anyway. So that was unfortunate for sure. And but that did have an effect on what the Oscars are recognizing. And I think, you know, they're trying to make a statement in their Oscar nominations that they're not going to take this anymore. And actually, it was announced today. Normally, the acting awards at the Oscars are presented by the people who won those awards in the previous year. So whoever won Best Actor presents the Best Actress award in the next year, and whoever won Best Actress presents Best Actor and that kind of thing. And last year, the winner was Casey Affleck.
Whoops.
And it was announced today that he's not going to be presenting the award. That was a big kind of, that was something people were kind of concerned about. And so there does seem to be this push in the Hollywood industry to eradicate that image of sexual harassment. And that's the great thing. And that's great to see. So now, Mike, we should get into the Oscar nominations, get a little talk about what's going on there. Wanted to talk about some of the surprises. I mean, so were you there like live when they were happening, Mike? Because I was actually watching the feed of Andy Serkis and Tiffany Haddish announcing the nominations.
I was watching it, but without the sound on because I was on the subway with no headphones. So I was just waiting to hopefully catch the frame where they showed what category and who was nominated. So not the full experience, but okay. I got to see the words pop up live.
Yeah. All right. So we'll get into some of the more detail on some of the nominees. But first off, let's just say what all the Best Picture nominees are. There's 9 of them this year, and it's always weird. So the originally, you know, for like 80 years, it was like 5 movies at a time. That was it. And then they expanded it in the around 2008, 2009. 2009 was the first year they expanded it to 10 nominees because they wanted to recognize more widely seen movies. The reason they expanded it is because they snubbed The Dark Knight is basically what what happened. So 2009 they expanded to 10 nominees, and then a couple years later they changed it so that it can be anywhere between 5 and 10 nominees. And I think that is ridiculous. it's just very weird because then you have 9 nominees for Best Picture, and it's like, oh, the 10th one wasn't good enough. Like, it just
didn't make the cut.
And so there are movies that, you know, were potential Oscar favorites that just didn't make Best Picture. So here are the nominees for Best Picture. There are 9 of them. They are Call Me By Your Name, Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, Get Out, Lady Bird, Phantom Thread, The Post, The Shape of Water, and 3 Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. First thing I can observe is that both of our number ones are on this list. Mine was 3 Billboards. Yours was Get Out. And it's an interesting category. First of all, I think this is the best lineup of movies that the Oscars have had in a long, long time.
I'm pretty sure all 9 of these can win.
Yeah, that's the thing. I feel like most years, you know, you're in the Oscar race, you're seeing things, and you're seeing these different award shows, like award stuff, and you can sort of see, like, what's building momentum. And by the time the Oscars get there, there's always, like, only, like, 1 or 2 possibilities of what could possibly win these awards. And this year, I could easily see 5 or 6 of these movies like just running away with it. I think right now the favorite is 3 Billboards. That's what I've been seeing a lot. It won the Golden Globe. It won the SAG Award for Best Cast. But a bunch of acting awards have been won by 3 Billboards as well. But then there's The Shape of Water, which has been winning a lot of other things. Guillermo del Toro won Best Director at the Golden Globes. Guillermo del Toro also won Best Director at the DGAs, the Directors Guild of America, and I think it won the Producers Guild as well. And there's a whole bunch of other stuff. Phantom Thread got a surprising amount of love at the Oscars, by the way. Got 6 nominations. Shape of Water got 13, which is, you know, insane. I think if the Oscars were held today, 3 Billboards would probably win. I think The Shape of Water might take it. I think the Sexy Fish movie might be the Best Picture winner for 2018, and I would love
Hashtag
that so
Fish
much.
Daddy 2018.
Yeah.
It's happening.
Yeah, but then who knows? Like, I mean, Get Out was such a runaway success, and the fact that we're even talking about it in the Oscar conversation to me is insane. Like, I love that. You know, and so there's so much other stuff. But then you have the Best Director category, which I think is even better. Because I want all these people to win, and I'm upset that we only have to vote for one of them.
Can't we just give participation Oscars?
Exactly. Can't everybody just get an Oscar? Like, that would be nice. Yeah. First of all, you've got 2 first-timers. Two people who – it's their first time directing a movie in Best Director. Jordan Peele for Get Out and Greta Gerwig for Lady Bird. And these are people whose work I've been following for so long. I mean, Jordan Peele, one half of Key and Peele is an Oscar-nominated director. That is insane to me. And Greta Gerwig, who's been like co-writing great movies and acting in great movies for so long, she's been such a great indie talent. Very excited to see her in this Best Director category. And then outside of them, you have 3 master filmmakers, 2 of which have never been nominated for Best Director. And one of them has only been nominated once. That one was Paul Thomas Anderson. He was nominated for There Will Be Blood. But he's in there for Phantom Thread. And I didn't expect that. I didn't see that coming. And then Guillermo del Toro in Best Director. Like, that's amazing. I love him.
Yeah.
And Christopher Nolan is nominated for Dunkirk. How has Christopher Nolan never been nominated for Best Director before?
Because they snubbed Dark Knight.
Exactly. I mean, that to me is just incredible. Like, I... Somebody tweeted it out that, like, oh, this is for Christopher Nolan's first time being nominated for Best Director. And I was like, that can't be right. He must
have... That person's wrong.
Yeah, he must have been... I could have sworn he was nominated for Inception or something. But no, he's his first time, which is pretty nuts. And I think Del Toro will probably take that award home. And I got to say, I'm down. I think that's... like, I'm just happy for him. He's such a lovely guy. But were there surprises in this on these nominations that got you, Mike? Anything that you thought about that was interesting?
I don't think so. I mean, it's surprising, you know, like we were just talking about that, how many of these people and award these nominees are like can just, I think, deserve it and should win. All nine movies, all five directors, just everyone that wrote all the screenplay people. Yeah, they got it. And I did see an amazing tweet that was a screenshot of Bradley Whitford from Get Out that said, you know, if I could, I would have nominated Get Out three times for Best Picture. Which was amazing.
That's good.
But I don't know. I think this will be a very interesting and exciting Oscars.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think there's
is nice. That's refreshing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, last year was one of the most exciting Oscars of all time, but only because of the ending.
But by accident.
Yeah, but by accident. And this time, I feel very like excited to see who could win these things because they're all awesome. Really good. And the only one I haven't seen is in the Best Picture race is Darkest Hour, which I should end up seeing at some point soon. The rest of which I have, though, and all of these I think are pretty much deserving. I would probably get rid of like one or two of these, but otherwise this is a rock solid lineup of movies. As far as surprises go, there's a lot of love for Phantom Thread, like I mentioned before. Six nominations, mm-hmm. including Best Picture and Best Director, Best Actor for Daniel Day-Lewis, also nominated for Best Supporting Actress for Leslie Manville, and a couple of other things. I know for sure it'll win Best Costume Design. There's no way it doesn't.
The movie about fashion. They're out.
It's absolutely the one that'll win that. But also, Logan got nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay.
Yeah, that's true.
Which is, to me, that's incredible to me right there. And The Big Sick nominated for Best Original Screenplay. Kumail Nanjiani and Emily V. Gordon are now Oscar nominees.
Yeah, and that's crazy.
That is insane to me. Also, Netflix getting in the game this year with Mudbound, nominated in four categories, including Best Supporting Actress for Mary J. Blige, and Best Cinematography, which... You know, Rachel Morrison is the cinematographer for Mudbound, first woman ever to be nominated in cinematography.
That's insane.
In 90 years of Academy Awards, the first woman to ever be nominated in cinematography for Mudbound. So that's pretty insane right there.
That's awesome, but makes me so nervous for my dude, Roger Deakins.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, yeah, Roger Deakins nominated in cinematography for Blade Runner 2049. Absolutely deserves the award. Not only because Blade Runner 2049 is the best looking movie of probably the decade, but also because Roger Deakins has been nominated 14 times
and,
and has never won the Oscar for cinematography. And that is insane to me. That goes all the way back to his first nomination, which was The Shawshank Redemption back in 1994. And he still hasn't won. Like he's probably deserved every award that there was one year where it was 2007. He was nominated twice, and he lost in both it was 2007, and he was nominated for No Country for Old Men and Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, and both of those should have won. Like
yes. What ended up winning that year? Do you remember?
I have no. I want to say it was Atonement, but I actually have no idea. You know what? I'm guessing it's either Atonement or There Will Be Blood. I'm looking it up right now.
We're gonna do it live.
But it is just insane to me that Roger Deakins has not. Hold on.
Every one of his movies is the most beautiful movie to have been made.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like he's been working with the Coen brothers. He's been working with Sam Mendes. He's been working for so many other people. There Will Be Blood was the winner of 2007. Although Atonement was nominated, so I wasn't that off. There Will Be Blood was the winner for 2007. Here's the thing. I'm not sure if he will win. Because here's the thing, and this is something that was pointed out to me. No winner for it's very rare for an Academy Award winner for cinematography to be a movie that wasn't nominated for Best Picture. And Blade Runner 2049 not nominated for Best Picture. You have to go all the way back to 2006 actually to find the last time that happened, which was Pan's Labyrinth. It's gonna be interesting to see how this shakes out. I really hope he gets it. Because, you know, he absolutely deserves it at this point. Dude, 68 years old, been the best cinematographer in the business for so fucking long.
Yeah.
But, you know, if he can't get it, like, Mudbound was a great, like, really well-shot movie, and Rachel Morrison is deserving of the award as well. What else in the category? Darkest Hour, Dunkirk, and The Shape of Water. All of those, I didn't see Darkest Hour, but Dunkirk and The Shape of Water are also really well-shot movies as well. I think Dunkirk will probably take that. Honestly, like, I think Dunkirk will take that award.
You take that back.
I'm just saying. I think Blade Runner absolutely deserves it. I think Dunkirk will take that award. And
it's too good. It's too good for the Oscars. That's the problem.
That's exactly the problem.
For the plebeians at the Academy.
Other stuff. I mean, Shape of Water, tied to everything, 13 nominations. Baby Driver got in on those tech awards, got 3 nominations there. Obviously for the sound editing, because, like, you know, how could it not?
That's the whole movie.
Yeah, and I don't think it'll win those awards, just because it's not. I mean, I'm glad it was nominated, but those also seem like Dunkirk awards to me. But it got sound editing and film editing as well, which is very cool, and it absolutely deserves cool. that. And everything is just so cool in here, man. I'm really happy. And yeah, like I mentioned before, it seems like the Academy has rejected James Franco. He did not make the Best Actor category, although Disaster Artist was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. So that's kind of interesting. It's like the film itself isn't disgraced, but perhaps James Franco himself is. And it's interesting to see how they're going to react to this. But instead, the Best Actor category, Timothée Chalamet for Call Me By Your Name, DDL for Phantom Thread, Daniel Kaluuya for Get Out, Gary Oldman, Darkest Hour, and Denzel Washington for Roman J. Israel, Esquire. And that's the slot that I think James Franco would have gone in.
I could see that.
Yeah, I feel like, because nobody saw Roman J. Israel, Esquire. I've heard not great things about it. I'm sure Denzel Washington is very good in it. You know, it doesn't seem like something that, you know, it would have been recognized if not for, the fact that James Franco, was suddenly, excommunicated. But I'm surprised they didn't replace him with, like, Tom Hanks in The Post or something. Cause I feel like that would,
something a little less, just off the bottom of the barrel.
So that's what that category is. And first of all, Daniel Kaluuya and Get Out. That's a cool nomination right there. That's very nice. And then Best Actress, you've got my favorite performance of the year, Sally Hawkins in The Shape of Water, as well as Frances McDormand, Three Billboards, Margot Robbie, I, Tonya, Saoirse Ronan, Lady Bird, and Meryl Streep, The Post. And by the way, I, Tonya, nominated in a couple of acting categories, not nominated for Best Picture, and that was kind of a favorite to be in that conversation. So that could have been that 10th movie that just didn't make it in.
Yeah, that was the one.
And then Best Supporting Actor, you've got Willem Dafoe for The Florida Project, Woody Harrelson, Three Billboards, Richard Jenkins, Shape of Water, Christopher Plummer for All the Money in the World.
Sure. Fuck you, Kevin Spacey.
Exactly. That's honestly what that nomination is.
Oh, yeah.
It's a Fuck You, Kevin Spacey award. Also, he's 88 years old, makes him, I think, the oldest acting nominee of all time. So that's pretty wild. And Sam Rockwell for Three Billboards, also in Supporting Actor. And I think of any locks this year, like people who I think are definitely going to win, I think Sam Rockwell for Three Billboards will win the Oscar. And that makes me happy because Sam Rockwell's the best.
True.
And I think Frances McDormand's probably going to win Best Actress for Three Billboards as well. Best Supporting Actress, you've got Mary J. Blige for Mudbound, Allison Janney for I, Tonya, Leslie Manville for Phantom Thread, Laurie Metcalf for Lady Bird, and then Octavia Spencer for The Shape of Water, which is a pleasant surprise. Didn't see that one coming. And I think all these are pretty good. I think the only movies I haven't seen here are Darkest Hour and Roman J. Israel, Esquire, and All the Money in the World, actually. But Gary Oldman was kind of the favorite to win Best Actor, I think, at this point for Darkest Hour. But I don't know, man. I like, certain stuff is starting to come to light about Gary Oldman. It doesn't seem like it's like sexual harassment stuff, but it might be like he has sort of abusive past, and that's not great either. So I don't know, because he just won the SAG Award this past weekend, which is a pretty good indicator of who will win. But now, like, there's 2 months between now and when voting ends. I think it's going to be either, like, if it's not Gary Oldman, I think it's going to be between Timothée Chalamet or Daniel Day-Lewis for Best Actor. Yeah. And because this is, I mean, DDL's last run. He's retiring after this.
Yeah. They'll give it to him just to, because they can.
Yeah. And that would be his fourth Oscar, which would be something. But
that's crazy.
Yeah. That is insane. Other thoughts, Mike? Hey, The Boss Baby nominated for Best Animated Feature Film. That's
Hashtag bless. Wait, what's the feature? I don't think that might have been one category I didn't see somehow. What's the full category for that?
The Best Animated Feature Film. It's a weird one. The Boss Baby, The Breadwinner, Coco, Ferdinand, and Loving Vincent. So,
man, what a stretch.
Yeah, it's, first
they made
all,
that whole category, and then they struggle to fill it, it seems.
Yeah, it's. It, I mean, a couple of them are like, they do this every year where it's like a couple of big ones, and they always throw in like a couple of like really small like indie animated movies, and that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
So that's what I think The Breadwinner and Love and Vincent are. I haven't seen either of them. But yeah, The Boss Baby, Coco, and Ferdinand. It's like, dude, Lego Batman movie is right there. Like, Lego Batman is right there. And then this the Lego movie didn't get nominated. I remember
yeah.
that. Like that was a huge thing. Like how, you know? Because the Lego movie, not only the best animated movie of that year, like one of the best movies of that year, period, and just didn't get in there. And yeah, Lego Batman right there. There was a Cats and Underpants movie this year that was supposed to be pretty good. I didn't hear nothing about that. You know, Your Name. Give me Your Name in there somewhere. You know, but yeah. Also, Star Wars: Last Jedi nominated it for Best Original Score for John Williams, which I think is kind of neat. Because I think it is a really underrated score from him. But also Dunkirk, Phantom Thread, Shape of Water, and Three Billboards, all really well-deserving scores as well. But yeah, just a really insane, like, I feel like I haven't been this happy with an Oscar nomination in a long time. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Like I said before, this is going to be a refreshingly exciting year for the Oscars.
Yeah,
I hope.
Yeah, and it's gonna be a little while. They're airing in March this year, which is just too late. Why is that? Yeah, March 4th, and hosted by Jimmy Kimmel again. So should be a fun show. I'm looking forward to it. Anyway, I think that about wraps up our discussion about the Oscars, Mike. We will of course talk about them when they air again. But right now, let's move on into our discussion.
Watch this. These are my discussions. Just when I thought I said all I could say, my buddy and I talk about movies we see. These are my discussions. There is so much to see, you and me. So we're going to talk about movies for our discussions.
All right, it's time for our discussions here on Film Bookcast. Mike, what do you have to discuss with us today?
Today I have two movies. The first is Lone Wolf and Cub 4. This one's titled Baby Cart in Peril.
Okay.
Not. I don't think they'll ever top, any movie will ever top Baby Cart to Hades, which was the third one. but Baby Cart in Peril is still pretty good. This is another sequel to the Shogun Assassin, Lone Wolf and Cub is the name of the franchise, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. The kind of exiled Ronin samurai trying to just survive in feudal Japan with his son. And they just are relentlessly hunted by other samurai and ninjas and crazy assassin shit. And it's just that kind of like 70s pulpy, literal Monty Python fountains of blood in the sword fights. Like there's a moment where, you know, he there's a samurai duel and the main character wins and he ends with his sword in the other guy's chest and he asks him to, like, you know, cut his head off in seppuku or harikari or whatever.
Yeah.
And he pulls the sword out and it's like a literal fire hose of blood. And it's like the funniest thing ever. The best. Nice.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Did you like it more than Baby Cart to Hades or less than that one?
I think it's I don't know if I want to say I liked it more. I think I liked Baby Cart to Hades more.
Okay.
But the franchise is starting to get really like philosophical just about this, like, you know, the kind of you know, where all these kind of like franchises about killers go, where like the life of, like, Logan kind of thing, like, you know, the life of violence and that toll that takes on you. And it gets real weird for a while, like just kind of weird flashbacks and like dreamy 70s stuff, like wind chimes. There's wind chimes happening. So it's fun. You know, it's that kind of that pulpy grindhouse kind of, not grindhouse, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Midnight movie style kind of thing.
Sure.
And movie number two is All the Money in the World, directed by your boy Ridley Scott.
Yes. Yeah. My boy Ridley Scott. I have not had the chance to see this yet. And that kind of bums me out. I've heard pretty decent things. And of course, there was a whole hullabaloo about Christopher Plummer replacing Kevin Spacey. So there's a lot of publicity surrounding this movie. And I just haven't had I've been seeing so many other movies that I just haven't had the time for All the Money in the World. And now it just left my Regal Theater and is now at the Dollar Theater next door.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so I mean, I have MoviePass anyway, so it's whatever. But
oh, Mr. Moneybag.
Oh, you can afford $10 a month.
Yeah, look at you.
Yeah, but anyway, so I do plan on seeing it pretty soon. I might wait for it to hit Blu-ray because I probably get better quality on Blu-ray than I would getting it in the Dollar Theater. But
yeah, Yeah. Probably.
But so what did you think, Mike? What did you think of All the Money in the World?
I thought it was actually pretty cool. It's the real life story of Paul Getty being kidnapped in the early 70s, I think.
Yeah.
They will do things to Paul that cannot be undone for any amount of money. We have to pay.
This simply isn't possible. My financial position has changed.
Really? I mean, 30 seconds ago, you said it was a good day. I mean, I'm not all that bright, but I can multiply as well as you. With oil up as much as it was this morning, you have amassed another fortune.
Well, what if the embargo is lifted and oil were to crash? I'd be exposed. I have never been more vulnerable financially than I am right now.
Mr. Getty, with all due respect, nobody has ever been richer than you are at this moment.
I have no money to spare.
What would it take? I mean, what would it take for you to feel secure?
More.
And the story of them, the family trying to get him back, and all, you know, the J.P. Getty, the grandfather, famously refused to pay the ransom that the kidnappers set. And it's kind of about that inner turmoil within the family and about why, you know, that whole situation and why Getty is just like the worst human. Right. Or seems to be the worst human, at least.
Yeah.
And Mark Wahlberg and Michelle Williams. Michelle Williams plays the mother, and Mark Wahlberg is like the former CIA agent or whatever the hell that Getty employs to try to get his grandson back.
Yeah.
And it does a pretty good mix of kind of like that 70s espionage thing, like, you know, Mark Wahlberg being a spy and stuff, which I think I might have been expecting more of. I don't know if I remember seeing a trailer and it kind of hyped that aspect of the film up more, made it seem more like an action-y type movie. So it doesn't have as much of that as I thought was going on, which is fine. I think, you know, that I just went in with an incorrect expectation, which is why trailers are bad, kids. Stay away from trailers. No. but everyone is turning in an awesome performance. Michelle Williams is the fucking dopest. She's great. Christopher Plummer, obviously great, worthy of an Oscar, just to rub their middle fingers on Kevin Spacey's face. which is honestly the main reason that I really wanted to see this movie was just to see. Did he, like, they did it? That Ridley Scott actually managed to do this?
Yeah.
And, like, yeah, they did. That's, it happened. Crazy, it's for real. Yeah.
So those scenes are seamless? Like, they don't feel like they're from a different movie or something like that?
Yeah, no, there's no, yeah, nothing like, there's one scene that looks like, oh, yeah, that's in front of a green screen instead of all the other ones are not. But otherwise, no, it doesn't feel weird or out of place. And like it doesn't look like they had to digitally remove a mustache off anybody or anything. Anything like that.
I've been making jokes about that for so long. You know, there was the first teaser image for Mission Impossible 6 that came out today of Tom Cruise hanging off a helicopter, and it looks awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking to myself, there's a trailer coming out pretty soon, and we're going to see full mustachioed Henry Cavill.
It's going to happen.
And it's going to be like, oh, this is the glory that we could have had in Justice League.
You know that once we finally get that image, it will immediately be photoshopped into Superman. Like,
oh,
it'll.
Yeah.
It's we're gonna get that version. It'll be like the unspecialized Star Wars movies, whatever, the despecialized cut or whatever, right, the fan made version.
Yeah, when they remove all the special edition changes and stuff like that.
Yeah,
they just add a mustache. It's beautiful. The mustache cut of Justice League is gonna be something to see. So anyway, yeah, that's All the Money in the World.
Yes, there is a weird thing there. There's a weird turn at the very end. It's not even really a turn, but it kind of undercut a lot of the movie for me. And I don't know exactly how to phrase it without spoiling stuff.
Yeah.
But you know, they kind of frame Getty in this specific light of him refusing to this kind of like miserly, you know, curmudgeonly old dude that won't spend any dollars.
Right.
And they kind of like at the very end, they give like a, but maybe this is why he was like that. And it's like, no, you just totally undercut the whole, like the whole relationship that he has with everyone in the movie.
Rosebud was
weird,
a sled.
Yeah. Rosebud was a penny, except in this situation kind of thing. Yeah. I don't know. It felt weird. And it sort of felt like, you know, cause he's kind of framed as a villain for most of the movie. And then they kind of like, well, but maybe he's had this other side of him. Like, yeah, I don't know. That's my only gripe with all the money in the world.
Okay, yeah, I've heard good things. I look forward to checking that out. All right, I have a few things to talk about, Mike. I have 5 movies and a TV show to plow through here. So, yeah, I've been to theater a lot over the past couple weeks. First movie I want to talk about is Molly's Game.
I threw 4 people under the bus for $35,000, Charlie. I noticed you kept that out of your speech to the prosecutor.
No, don't do that.
I took advantage of gambling addicts. Donnie Silverman, my brilliant find. He lost $6 million on my table.
Stop.
Moved to Florida.
Uh-huh.
Got a job as a substitute teacher. Then hanged himself.
Oh, and that's your fault. That's
Donnie
not
Silverman's
your fault.
Dead. Harlan Eustace is in jail in Nevada wishing he was, but that's not why I'm saying no.
You're not saying no.
I was named after my great-grandmother.
I don't care.
Molly.
We will stay here all night until you understand. Until you understand, nobody gives a shit about your good name.
I do.
Why?
Because.
Why?
Because.
Tell me why.
Because it's all I have left. Because it's my name.
And this is the new movie written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. And it stars Jessica Chastain as Molly Bloom, a woman who ran the most exclusive high-stakes poker game in the country before being shut down by the feds. This was like early 2000s. And it also stars Idris Elba as her lawyer, Kevin Costner as her dad, and Michael Cera as a player X, who's a combination of a few different high-profile celebrities that took part in her game, like Leonardo DiCaprio, Ben Affleck, Tobey Maguire. Supposedly, he's actually playing Tobey Maguire in the movie. Like that's like from what
that's
I,
amazing.
From what I hear, he's mostly doing that. Also, Steve from Stranger Things in this for
what?
For like a hot minute, which is kind of nice. Yeah, this is a really sharp script. It's also very distinctly Aaron Sorkin. I think your enjoyment of this movie depends on how much you enjoy the work of Aaron Sorkin, I think. And I happen to be somebody who really likes Aaron Sorkin most of the time. I think he can be left unchecked and left to his own devices. He can be overindulgent and preachy and often not great, and especially not great with female characters. Mm-hmm. That was a huge problem with The Newsroom, which is a show I generally liked but had a lot of issues with. However, that's not really the case here. He does a great job writing Molly in this movie. And, you know, there are some scenes that are just incredible in only the way he can make them. It has that very Sorkin-esque dialogue. It really pops. And also really gets you into the process of poker, even if you know nothing about poker, like me. I was enthralled. There's like a scene where one character is playing poker and he has nothing, but he's like bluffing, and like the other character is like kind of like trying to read him, and like it's one of the most like exhilarating things I've ever seen in like a movie this year. It was awesome. So definitely check out Molly's Game, and it's Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut, and I think he does a good job here. So worth checking out. Also saw I, Tonya.
How do I get a fair shot here? Because I'm up at 5 every morning working my ass off. Does someone want to just tell me to my face you're never going to give me the scores I deserve?
This is how it's done. Some of these girls have paid their dues.
I don't give a shit. I outskated them today.
We also judge on presentation.
Well, you know what? If you can come up with $5,000 for a costume for me, then I won't have to make one. Till then, just stay out of my face.
Maybe you're just not as good as you think. Maybe you should pick another sport.
Suck my dick.
And that's directed by Craig Gillespie, who is known for directing Lars and the Real Girl. Also did the Fright Night remake that came out a few years ago. This is a pretty good dark comedy retelling of the story of Tonya Harding, right? So this has been in the awards conversation a lot. Margot Robbie is very good in it as Tonya Harding. And it's very heavily influenced by the films of Martin Scorsese in a way that felt kind of forced to me.
Hot take.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen people like really be into it, and you know, the poster of this movie says like quotes a Variety review that says it's the Goodfellas of figure skating, and multiple people have like texted me or talked to me about this movie and being like, yeah, it's like if Martin Scorsese directed a figure skating movie, and to me, it's more like, this is what it would be like if someone who watched a lot of Martin Scorsese movies directed a figure skating movie, and.
Burn.
Yeah, and like that's fine. I feel like it's, you know, it's using these Scorsese tropes, but it doesn't really understand what makes them work and what makes them powerful.
Right.
And you know, I that said, like it's a pretty fun movie. I think it's a solid dark comedy. And like I said, Margot Robbie's great in it. And Allison Janney as her mother is also very good. There's a lot of funny moments. And it's a movie that I enjoyed. I just didn't. I didn't feel what other people were feeling with that movie. Which is a bummer, but that happens sometimes. What I will say I really enjoyed for this next movie I'm talking about is Phantom Thread.
No, Alma, what's he doing?
There's tea for you.
Don't put the tray on the table, please. Just take it off. I shouldn't ask for tea.
No, but...
Take it out, please.
Yes, I can take it out.
It's a bit late now, isn't it?
I'm taking it out.
Yeah, but it's a bit late now, isn't it?
But I'm taking it out.
The tea is going out. The interruption is staying right here with me.
The new movie from director Paul Thomas Anderson, and of course starring Daniel Day-Lewis. And I gotta say, I was sort of on the fence about this as I was watching it. Like, this is something that I had no idea what to make of this movie while I was watching it. I was enjoying it. Like, I was enjoying the movie, but I was, it almost felt like I was at a remove from most of its runtime, right? I was just like, kind of like observing it and being like, how does this, like, what is this?
Is this a real thing?
Like, why, like, I don't understand. And then, like, that last 5 minutes happens and everything just clicks into place. Like, everything just lands. And it's one of the most, like, fiendishly clever dark comedies in years. I feel like it's a movie that is just a 2-hour buildup to a single joke almost. It's
the Aristocats.
The Aristocats, yeah. Honestly, this is kind of the Aristocrats of 1950s social dramas.
Oh, God.
But, yeah, I think this movie is often surprisingly very funny. I think it's the most passive-aggressive movie I've ever seen in my entire life. Wow. And it just feels like something that I haven't seen done very often. This is an exploration of a relationship in 1950s London that just does not go the way you think movies like this tend to go. Like, when you hear, you know, Daniel Day-Lewis plays a 1950s dressmaker in London, like, that sounds like a very stuffy period piece movie. And this is decidedly not that. There's a very modern humor throughout. And it's not even modern. Like, everything feels like almost at a remove, you know? Like, if everything feels like sort of another world. But at the same time, it sort of feels modern. But that final 5 minutes just seals the deal. It makes me want to watch it again real soon. And Daniel Day-Lewis, as always, is amazing in this movie. But I want to give a shout-out to Vicky Krieps, who plays woman, I forget the character's name, but she plays the woman who Day-Lewis is in a relationship with. She's great, and she completely holds her own against Daniel Day-Lewis, and, you know, she's somebody who hasn't acted in a bunch of things before, I don't think. So it's exciting to see her. It sort of reminded me of an Inherent Vice. Catherine Waterston kind of had her breakout role in that movie,
right.
And suddenly she was in a lot of things. Like, she was in Fantastic Beasts and Logan Lucky and Alien and all that stuff. And so I think, I really hope that Vicky Krieps has a similar trajectory after Phantom Thread, because she is really great in this movie. But yeah, well worth checking out, and I think it's surprising to me that this movie got 6 nominations at the Oscars, because watching it, like, on the surface level, you hear DDL in a 1950s London costume drama. Sure, that sounds like it'll be nominated for a bunch of Oscars. But when you watch the movie, it's like, how is this being nominated for Oscars? Like, are the Oscars getting this, you know?
It's, you can't forget PTA, though, my
exactly.
boy.
That's the thing. PTA, one of the... We're just shortening all the names now. It's much
easier. We're just making up things now.
PTA is one of the most interesting filmmakers working today, and, you know, he's one of the most visually dynamic. He co-wrote this movie, I think he co-wrote it with Daniel Day-Lewis, or DDL had at least some input on what the story was. And you know, everything about this just it really clicks. It really clicks in that last 5 minutes. So as long as you're patient with it and you're willing to go where this movie goes. It's a ride, man. It's a ride.
All right.
And that's Phantom Thread. And then I wanted to talk about another Oscar nominee, Mike, Call Me By Your Name. I saw that, last weekend, and, I'm a little bummed to say this one didn't do that much for me.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That sounds different. Did you change it?
Well, I changed it a little bit.
Why?
I just played it the way List would have played it if he'd altered box version.
Play that again.
Play what again?
The thing you played outside.
Oh, you want me to play the thing I played outside?
Please. Change it again.
Oh, I changed it a little bit.
Yeah, why?
I just played it the way Buzzoni would have played it if he'd altered Liszt's version.
And what is wrong with Bach, the way Bach would have played Bach's
Bach
version?
Never wrote it for the guitar. In fact, we're not even sure Bach wrote
Forget
it.
Forget I asked.
Kind of found it kind of overlong, meandering. Central character played by Timothée Chalamet just comes off as kind of uninteresting to me. There is a lot of stuff to enjoy here, for sure. I think it's incredibly well shot. All the performances are good. You know, Chalamet is good in the role, and Armie Hammer is good in his role. Especially Michael Stuhlbarg, who has a great scene towards the end. He's great in this movie. And actually, he's had a phenomenal 2017. Michael Stuhlbarg was in Call Me By Your Name, The Post, and The Shape of Water. which is pretty huge. But yeah, ultimately just didn't do that much for me. And I kind of get why people are into it, and I respect that. It just wasn't my thing. I did really like the director's previous film, Luca Guadagnino, I think is the director's name. He directed a movie called A Bigger Splash a couple years ago. And I think I might have liked that a little more just because it had Ralph Fiennes dancing to Emotional Rescue by the Rolling Stones. And it was delightful. But
what more could you ask for?
Exactly. But now I'll talk about the movie that I saw as a double feature with Call Me By Your Name. The weirdest double feature of all time. Right after I saw Call Me By Your Name, I saw The Commuter with Liam Neeson.
Wow. A little palate cleanser.
Why are you going to Cold Spring?
That's none of your business.
What's in the bag?
My God, what is with you people and my bag? Jeez. Hey, what are you doing? Let go of me.
I'm trying to help.
Seriously, come on, do something.
Who is that?
What's your problem?
Mike, you gotta let the lady go.
You don't get it, do you? She wants you dead. You witnessed a murder. You have something that she wants. Something she's willing to kill for.
Okay, Mike, you gotta let her go, Mike. Let the lady go. Mike.
Hand me the phone.
Mike, come on. Mike,
don't move. Stay in your seats. Right. Please, hand me the phone.
I will tell you, I think I like The Commuter more.
A cinematic sorbet.
Exactly. This is the new movie from director Jean-Claude Serra, who I think is now the official king of just elevating genre schlock into something that's slick and more interesting. This is his fourth collaboration with Liam Neeson. The two of them made Nonstop together, which is one of my favorite Liam Neeson action movies. Yep. It's a very similar premise to that movie. In Nonstop, Liam Neeson's on a plane, and in this one, Liam Neeson's on a train. And
and that's the only difference.
And in the next one, he'll be in an automobile, and then they'll just and then they'll just remake Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, but with Liam Neeson punch people every once in a while. This time Liam Neeson finds himself in an extraordinary situation when a mysterious woman gives him $100,000 to find a passenger on the train. And it wears its Alfred Hitchcock influence on its sleeve, and it's not subtle about its political point of view, and also Liam Neeson smacks a guy in the head with a guitar neck. It's a blast.
Sign me up.
Yeah, and when I say the Hitchcock influence, I mean, there's literally, like, I mean, it has, like, that kind of Hitchcock everyman thrown into an extraordinary situation plot element to it. It kind of has rings of Strangers on a Train throughout it. But also, there's one shot that is deliberately very Hitchcock, which is it does the dolly zoom thing, which also Spielberg copied in Jaws, where the foreground zooms in, but the background zooms out at the same time. It does that, and it's like, I kind of geeked out in the theater when I saw it. It was pretty cool. But when I say about the political point of view as well, like part of the movie is that Liam Neeson has lost his job due to the economy and stuff like that. And there's a bit in the movie, there's a character who Liam Neeson's investigating, who's a stockbroker. And he's on his Bluetooth phone, and like he's ignoring Liam Neeson. And Liam Neeson just like gets his attention, and he just says, "Hey, Goldman Sachs, on behalf of the American middle class, fuck you." And he like gives him the middle finger. And and I was like, yeah! I don't think it's as good as Nonstop, which I think is a really, really fun...
A perfect movie? Oh.
Yeah. You're not wrong, man. You're not wrong. Although, I do still think Jean-Claude Serra's best movie is one that you won't believe is good. I keep telling you about it. The Shallows with Blake Lively.
Shut your whore mouth.
So good, man. I actually just got that on Blu-ray, so we're going to watch that pretty soon.
Okay, fine.
But anyway, yeah, I think this is a lot of fun and well worth checking out, especially if you like Nonstop. Actually, also a side note about this movie, most of it takes place in my area, like my neck of the woods.
Really?
Well, because he's on a train, and it's a train from Grand Central to Poughkeepsie.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And so every time the train stops, it's mostly done in real time. And so every time the train stops, it's like, oh, hey, it's Tarrytown. Oh, hey, it's Garrison. Oh, hey, it's Cold Spring. We're getting off at Cold Spring now. And the big climax of the movie takes place in Beacon. And it like right outside the Beacon train station, which is like 5 minutes from my house. And so I was this is pretty neat. That's a cool thing to see. But yeah. Anyway, that is The Commuter. And then finally, I wanted to give a brief shout out to a TV show that I've been watching on Netflix. It's a Netflix original, came out last year. It's called American Vandal.
All right, take a look at this. These are the dicks that you drew in Shapiro's class.
Yeah.
Right?
Of course.
And then this is the dicks that were drawn in the car.
Oh.
Yeah.
Shit.
They're completely different. Yeah.
Wow.
And we checked. Every single whiteboard dick that you drew in Shapiro's class all had hairs.
Yeah, I never forget the ball hairs. It's just, I mean, it's such an important part of the dick. And like the mushroom heads all off. Mine's way different. I usually just do like a, you know?
And the mushroom tip.
They really, that's like a heart almost.
And they didn't even bring it up in your case.
This is dope. This is really dope, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And have you heard about the show, Mike, at all?
I have heard of it in the way that you hear about Netflix shows and that you scan past it and you're like, I don't know what that is. And then you keep going.
Okay. I think you would love this show. Really? Okay, so you were a fan of Making a Murderer, right?
Yes.
Okay, you were really into that show, I remember, when that came out. So this is a comedy show, and it's a parody of Making a Murderer. It's a half hour, like, it's a parody of, like, these true crime documentaries, like Making a Murderer, The Jinx, Serial, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's about these kids in high school, and there's a crime that is committed in which 27 dicks are spray-painted onto cars.
We're too self-aware. This is too meta for me.
It's an eight episode season, investigating who actually drew the dicks. Cause one kid gets, crime pinned on him and it's likely that he did it, but there's evidence to suggest that he didn't. And so this one kid who's a documentarian is going into it and it's amazing, dude. It's so good. It gets the language and like the visual style of all those shows down so well. And I'm invested in what happens. I'm six episodes in. It's an eight episode season, and I can't wait to find out who drew the dicks. Like,
that's amazing.
It is an incredible show. I think you would love it, and it's a pretty brief watch. It's eight episodes. They're all half hour long. You could breeze through it really easily. It's really well worth checking out. It's available on Netflix right now. American Vandal. I don't remember the name of the guys who made it. I think they were like some YouTube stars or something. Like they are, like everybody from the show kind of came from YouTube. And went over to Netflix, and it is something else, man. And it's kind of funny to me that Netflix, made Making a Murderer, and now they're making American Vandal.
Yeah, that's just too meta, too much.
It is fantastic. Highly recommend American Vandal. I really think you should check it out. I think you would love it. And with that, I think we should wrap up our discussions, Mike, and move on into our featured review of The Post.
Okay, people are concerned about having a woman in charge of the paper. That she doesn't have the resolve to make the tough choices.
Thank you, Arthur, for your frankness.
Let's do our jobs. Find those pages.
You're talking about exposing years of government secrets.
Is that legal?
What is it you think we do here for a living, kid?
Ben, I might have something.
It must be precious cargo.
It's just government secrets.
All right, that was from the trailer for The Post. And before we get into any of our review, Mike, some late breaking news on Twitter. And I should say this is more of a rumor than actual news, although not technically a rumor. This seems to have some basis in it. A couple days ago, there was talk going around that Steven Spielberg was planning his next movies. And they were either going to be Indiana Jones 5 or West Side Story, a remake of West Side Story.
Okay.
And now Mark Harris, who's a writer that I follow on Twitter, just posted a tweet saying, "Exciting Harris/Kushner household news. Something's coming. Something good." Now, Kushner means Tony Kushner, who he's married to. Tony Kushner, screenwriter behind Lincoln, and also was working on another Spielberg movie, The Kidnapping of Edgardo Mortada, which hasn't been made yet.
Okay.
And he says, "Something's coming. Something's good," which is a West Side Story line. And he also has the poster for West Side Story in his tweet. And that's all he says. Mm-hmm. But I think what this means is that Spielberg's next movie will likely be a remake of West Side Story.
Yeah, that seems to track.
Yeah, and I think that's pretty wild. Spielberg's never directed a musical before.
What if it's not a musical, though?
You think he's just going to do Romeo and Juliet?
It's just like a gritty, lots of dolly zooms, close-up shocked faces.
Oh, wait a minute. Oh, shit. I'm looking at this. I'm actually looking at this poster a little closer now. It's a casting call poster, and it says, directed by Steven Spielberg. Adapted by Tony Kushner. So yes, Steven Spielberg is making a West Side Story remake, Mike. And it says dance experience a plus. So I'm gonna say it is a musical, Mike.
So it's actually a Step Up remake disguised as a West Side Story remake.
Not only is it a Step Up remake, Mike, it is a Step Up to the Streets remake.
Man, also a secret Venom sequel.
But anyway, yeah, I think that's pretty cool, and I'm sure we'll get more into that at a later date. But right now, we got to talk about the current Spielberg movie.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
That is out in theaters right now. It's called The Post, and it's written by Liz Hanna and Josh Singer and directed by Steven Spielberg. Also stars Meryl Streep, Tom Hanks, Sarah Paulson, Bob Odenkirk, Tracy Letts, Bradley Whitford, Bruce Greenwood, Matthew Rhys, and just about every recognizable character actor working in movies right now.
Mm-hmm.
Among several others. The IMDb plot synopsis for The Post reads, A cover-up that spanned four U.S. presidents pushed the country's first female newspaper publisher and a hard-driving editor to join an unprecedented battle between the press and the government. So, Mike, I think we're going to skip spoilers for this one because, like, what is there to spoil?
it was real life.
Yeah, it was real life. The papers got published, if anybody... sorry if anybody didn't know that. But, yeah. So, before we get into our full review, Mike, it is no secret. I am a massive fan of director Steven Spielberg.
Never noticed.
Yeah, and I know you are a fan as well. But, you know, I think apart from being arguably the biggest name in movie history... and defining pop culture several times over, he is also someone who has never really rested on his laurels. He's always taken like really interesting steps in his career, like for example, wanting to adapt a musical. Like that's something new that he hasn't done yet.
Yeah.
And sometimes there are misfires, but I'd say most of the time, there's real evidence of the careful craft and consideration and just pure filmmaking fun at the heart of a Spielberg movie. And critic Matt Zoller Seitz pointed out something interesting on Twitter a couple days ago, that in the recent years of his career, Spielberg seems dedicated to making the types of mid-budget dramas that his own massive blockbusters sort of led to the death of in most theaters, right? Like, he was the guy who made Jaws, and that opened the gates for everything else that followed. And he made the Indiana Jones movies and all that stuff. And, like, it's been, like, a slow death over 30 years of, like, mid-budget dramas kind of leaving theaters as much. Like, there's just not as many made anymore. And now that's really what Spielberg wants to make. Like, he makes the occasional blockbuster. He's doing Ready Player One in a couple of months. It's coming out in March. But for the most part, he's been doing, you know, smaller scale movies. And I think that's an interesting inverse of what he began his career doing. And also, The Post can form, like, a sort of loose trilogy that he's been making recently of American history dramas that act as allegory for today, alongside Lincoln and Bridge of Spies. Like, put The Post next to those two movies, and it sort of feels like Spielberg really has a lot on his mind. So let's get right into it. Mike, what was your thoughts on The Post?
I thought The Post is definitely a really interesting, I guess, I mean, it's hard to think of it as anything other than a meditation and allegory on America's current political climate.
Right. I don't think the movie wants you to think it's anything but that.
Right. I guess that's true. It's just lean it. That's what it is. Yeah. That's what they're doing. And it fucking succeeds a lot at that and makes life really scary. Although it has a happy ending, I guess, as far as that kind of thing could be concerned.
What, Watergate happens?
Watergate happens, yeah. they win the Supreme Court decision, yes, yeah. And the papers are published, and then Watergate happens. but it up until that point, it is pretty incredible to see, just like you said, every character actor in Hollywood in a scene together, furiously throwing papers around Tom Hanks's living room, which is reassuring. You know, I have these kind of a trepidation when you see a cast stacked like this sometimes.
Right.
You know, this huge ensemble cast, and it's just like, doesn't work. But in the hands of someone like Steven Spielberg, I have some more trust, I guess. And it's amazing to what, you know, Carrie Coon, our girl, friend of the show.
Friend of the show,
Carrie. Just going to say that about everybody.
Yeah. It does feel like every 2 minutes, like, somebody new pops up and it's like, oh, hey, David Cross. Like, hey.
Yeah.
Hey, Jesse Plemons. Like, what are you guys doing here? Hey, Michael Stuhlbarg, you're in this. Allison Brie, Zach Woods, what up? Like, I do think for the most part, this ensemble works pretty well. And it's all led by Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks, who I think are giving great performances. I mean, what I like about this movie, and I think this movie is just dynamic filmmaking straight up. I think it's the kind of movie that Spielberg could make in his sleep. But he doesn't.
True.
He doesn't do it. Like, the camera is always doing something interesting. It's always moving around. And Spielberg really favors long takes in this movie. There's a lot of like long things where the camera just kind of glides around the room, and you see Meryl Streep kind of talking to Tom Hanks. And, you know, Meryl Streep's gotten all the praise for this movie. I feel like she's nominated for Best Actress, of course, because it's number like 21 for her. I think is the actual number of nominations that she's had for the Oscars. And so that makes sense. But and she's very good. But I really think Tom Hanks is given the best performance in this movie. I think he is just straight up great. I think he is like fantastic. There's like nuance and there's like passion and there's like vocal and physical tics that he captures that I was just like really enraptured by. But then you got the whole ensemble surrounding them, and it's like Bob Odenkirk and Matthew Rhys play pretty significant roles, and then like boom, David Cross, Jesse Plemons, Alison Brie, Zach Woods. They all mesh really well together. They all feel like they are functional. You know, it's not like most of them aren't given like, you know, significant plot lines or anything like that. They're just kind of there as part of the scene, and I think they're all very good at that. I would say the only one that kind of gets a little bit of the short shrift is Sarah Paulson, who plays Tom Hanks' wife in the movie. And I feel like, you know, she sort of gets like a scene towards the end, but it feels like she like either she should have had a bigger role or like maybe somebody who wasn't as famous as Sarah Paulson
could have done that role.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. There's so many people in this, and there's so much happening that it feels like the kind of characters that are on the periphery of the you know the plot of the papers and like that whole journalistic plot line don't really get a chance to do anything, which I guess they don't really need to. But you said, it's like that's Sarah Paulson.
It's Sarah Paulson. Alison Brie too, I think, is the same. Like she's Meryl Streep's daughter, and she's like, okay, you're part of this, but like you're not really part of the movie plot. Like you're not really here.
Yeah. You brought food into this scene, and then you have left, and that's it.
And like, that's kind of what they do, and it's like, like you got Alison Brie for that, like that's, you know. But and it is very clear that you know the Post exists as an allegory for Donald Trump and his relationship to the news. There are times when I expected a character to look at the camera like Jim from The Office, like I was looking for Tom Hanks to like look at the camera and be like, hey, you believe this guy? Like,
wink with a ding sound effect. Like,
And I think for the most part, it's like just on the nose enough. Like, I think I was really worried because I had heard that, like, obviously this is going to have a parallels with the modern age. And I had heard that it kind of, and I think it kind of walks the line between being too on the nose and being just on the nose enough for like the majority of the movie. I think it does get to be a little much by the end. Like, if like, there's a couple of screenwriting bits where I'm just like, all right. like dial it back a little bit, but at the same time, it feels important, right? It feels like something that we need to watch, just to see how this all happened 40 years ago, and how dangerous it can be for it to happen again.
Yeah, there's one particular exchange between Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks where you know Tom Hanks is talking about he kind of comes to the realization or accepts the fact that he was sort of like used as a ruse by JFK in terms of his relationship to the press. And like, you know, I don't remember. I can't remember the exact line, but he said something to the effect of we can only be friends or sources with politicians. We can't be both. And that ends now or something like that. Right. And that's where it kind of, you know, it's like he turns to the camera and points kind of thing. But it also feels like an extremely important thing, like an important message and moment and a turning point for the press and for our democracy and our world. And it is interesting in some just kind of like historical regard to in my mind that like the Washington Post at one point was just a local Washington paper.
Yeah.
And right now it's them and they're like the most important paper, but them and the New York Times.
Yeah.
Which I also enjoy that like rivalry of them trying to catch the New York Times, like catch up to them. So it's throughout so much of this paper.
Interconnectedness of all the different papers and stuff like that, I thought was pretty cool. But yeah, and all this help. I think all this helps the fact that look, this is kind of a thin story, right? As far as stories go, like, you know, most of the movie is just one character deciding whether or not to publish the papers. That's basically the entire movie boiled down to a nutshell.
Yeah.
And it's a story that we already know the answer to. We know the papers are published. But I think just the way it's written and the way Spielberg shoots it and the way the actors portray these characters, it just feels like the most important event of all time when you're watching the movie. Like everything feels so important and exciting. And, you know, Odenkirk has a great line towards the end of the movie where he's saying, I've always wanted to take part in a small revolution. And I think that kind of sums up his whole character, I think. It's like, we want to be a part of something that is worth fighting for type thing. And I feel like that's part of the message kind of relating it to today's times. I do think the movie's a little messier than Lincoln or Bridge of Spies. And I think it sometimes feels a little bit rushed, right? I mean, the film was shot, edited, and finished in about 6 months.
Wow.
It all happened in 2017. Yeah, Spielberg was in post-production on Ready Player One. And we're just like, I'll make this too. And because the dude is a machine.
Yeah.
But, And I, but overall, I mean, I really enjoyed it. It is a movie of big capital M moments, right? About, you know, journalism and its vital role in American society. There's a moment where Kay Graham, Meryl Streep, decides to publish the papers and then verbally beats down Bradley Whitford's character. Got applause in my theater. Like my theater
really
in applause, and it's a drama about a newspaper like that. Like there's no superheroes in this. There's no
right. You know? What are you doing?
But it was a very powerful moment, and I felt that like there was a you know, and I was you know there was sort of like a tearing up in my own eyes because I was just like this is it was really powerful.
Yeah, and it doesn't hurt that it's Meryl Streep like fucking up everybody's day. And yeah, it's the best.
Other stuff though, I do think the Nixon stuff didn't really work for me so much. The way they shot him, I mean.
It was pretty weird.
Like Nixon as a character, I get it. Like you kind of need Nixon, but I think he could have been better as like an off-screen presence. Because the way he's shown in this movie, it kind of just makes him seem like George Steinbrenner on Seinfeld. Where
he's fucking exactly what he is.
he's always shown from the back. He's making these like big dramatic hand gestures. And you have like I guess like a Nixon impersonator doing his voice on the phone, or is it the actual voice of Nixon?
That's what I don't know, because that would be really interesting if it was the actual recording.
Okay,
it sounds like it, but I don't know.
Yeah, it might have been the actual recording, or it could have been like a Nixon impersonator. It sounded like him, like it sounded right.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just like you couldn't you
like only to. Over one shoulder. Like,
yeah, like you didn't like that was a little much. Although I think Grand Moff Nixon would have been way worse. So that's
holy shit.
You know, the all CGI Nixon would have
replaced the face. Yeah,
like that would have been even weirder than Peter Cushing. Like that would have been pushing. Mm-hmm. but also I think like Lincoln and Bridge of Spies, I think this movie has kind of the same problem where it doesn't really know when it's supposed to end. Because it has this, like, perfect shot towards the end where, you know, they're in the newspaper room and, you know, Meryl Streep says, like, man, I hope we never go through that again. And, like,
yeah.
And, like, it could have, like, faded out there. And, like, that's not a great line to end the movie on. But, like, it would have been fine. You know, that would have been fine. Right?
Yeah. It even it's sort of like the end of Casablanca, because it's them walking down a hallway away from the camera with the newspaper like printing press running, and they like kind of have this kind of quippy, you know, this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship type line.
Okay.
And then we'll just go do this other thing for 2 minutes to end the movie.
<That's>
like what?
It just keeps going on for like another minute, and we see the beginning of Watergate, right? Which is and it's which is fine, right? But it's like. Like we already know Watergate happens. Like you don't need to tell us that. And it doesn't really relate to the story that's being told in this movie, right?
No, but it's the punchline to "I hope we never go through that again." As Watergate happens immediately.
Okay. See, when she said "I hope we never go through that again," I thought that was like sort of a meta line about like how we're going through that right now.
Oh, well, that too, I guess. Yeah.
That's kind of how I read that. And so the Watergate thing just sort of felt like an epilogue, and it kind of feels like it's saying next time on The Post, like.
Who knows the darkness in the heart of men? The Post.
To be fair, I mean, that Watergate scene, I mean, I think it's solid. I think it has like a really intense, the score suddenly gets really intense.
It turns into like a horror movie for a second.
Yeah. And you see like the security guard wandering through the hotel, and he sees like a door and you hear like the dialogue of him calling the phone. And it's like, I think there's been a break in at the Watergate. And then he cuts.
Yeah.
Like it really goes all in on that. But the final shot of the movie, of like the camera zooming out of the Watergate Hotel. I've seen at least one person say that Spielberg is actually paying homage there to one of the opening shots of All the President's Men, which makes total sense. Like, that makes complete sense. Like I kind of get why he would do that now. If that is the case, because that's like All the President's Men pretty much picks up right where The Post left off.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. But otherwise, any other moments you want to talk about, Mike? Any other big scenes?
No, not particularly. I did, you know, the other parallels to modern day. There's the scene when from the Americans, Jesus,
Matthew Reeves.
There we go. Sorry. Yeah. When you know he's on the plane with the Secretary of State and everything, and he kind of relays his message, his experience that he's shocked at how. Much everything is the same in Vietnam and nothing has changed. And they walk off the plane and that guy, he immediately lies to the press. He just comes off and says, yeah, we're making great progress.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was a pretty, good, it's like, I don't know, telegraphing of the mood and, you know, the kind of everything that's going to happen from this movie.
Right.
And just another one of those, just kind of turn Jim face at the camera moments.
Yeah, exactly. It's also a really funny movie too. I haven't mentioned that. It's also like the dialogue's very funny. It's very snappy, but it never really feels out of place. It always feels like rooted in the characters. And I really feel like I could have watched these reporters at Tom Hanks's house, just being charged for lemonade by his daughter for another 2 hours. Just like them like furiously researching like government secrets and also like paying a dollar for lemonade like every 2 minutes. Yeah.
I'd watch that montage.
Yeah, it was great. It was great. So otherwise, I mean, I feel like I don't have, it's been a couple weeks since I've seen the movie, so I don't have like a lot of my thoughts have left my head because I've seen 20 other movies in theaters. Since then. But at the end of the day, I think this is a really strong movie. I'm not going to say it's one of Spielberg's best, but that's only because he's made like 50,000 movies and all of them are amazing. So
yeah, I mean, it's hard.
That's a little bit of exaggeration. Hook's not great, but like... But like for the most part, like I'm a huge fan of what Spielberg does, and The Post I think really taps into what his strengths are these days. You know, with Lincoln and Bridge of Spies and The Post, it really does feel like he has his mind on what the country is like right now, and how he can explore that using historical events. I think that's pretty cool, and so I'm excited to see the next chapter of his career. I mean, he's doing Ready Player One in a couple of months. That's coming out. And that's kind of a throwback to like his old blockbustery days. So, I'm eager to see that. I the trailers haven't really sold me on it. Like, I'm like on the one hand, like cool Iron Giant, but like at the same time, it's just, I don't know. I feel like it looks very drab, at least in the trailer.
Yeah, yeah. It seems. I mean, like we've talked about before, that's basically Steven Spielberg the book. Steven Spielberg movie, the book.
Yeah.
So I guess if anyone's going to adapt it, it should be him. So I'm excited for it.
I'm excited for it because it's Spielberg. But I just don't know what to expect from it. But then after that, I mean, he's got Indiana Jones 5 that he's still supposedly working on, and this West Side Story remake apparently that's happening. So yeah. he's busy, man. He's doing a lot of stuff. Plus,
he's got stuff to do.
Yeah, and there's the kidnapping of Edgardo Mortata whenever that happens. So a lot of Spielberg stuff happening in the near future, which is great. I'm glad that even in his old age, like he's in his 70s now, I think. Like even at this age, Spielberg is still cranking out movies left and right, and most of them are still pretty good. Like it's pretty cool. But anyway, does that wrap up our thoughts on The Post, Mike? Do we have more?
No, I think that's it. We've already we used our hour to talk about Marvel, the Oscars.
But yeah, too, no, yeah.
I think we did. We covered enough. The Post doesn't. It's an interesting thing where it doesn't. It's a very important message and it's an allegory for today and everything that's going on. But it doesn't. Like, there's nothing insane that stands out. It's just kind of. Is it's just kind of a statement, right? And I think we've said enough.
I think it's very cool. Yeah, and I mean it is kind of the movie that on the surface it feels like a movie that's being made just for awards, right? Like you have this plot and you have this cast and you have this director. It feels like an awards movie. But when you're watching it, I don't think it feels like an awards bait type movie. Like it has it has those big performances and stuff like that from Meryl Streep, but like it feels very vital and urgent in a way that a lot of awards type movies aren't. When I think of like Oscar baity movies, I think of something like The Theory of Everything, right? That feels like a movie. The Eddie Redmayne Stephen Hawking biopic, in case you forgot what that is. that feels like an awards baity type movie. Or like even in that same year there was The Imitation Game where Benedict Cumberbatch played Alan Turing, right? Basically when I think of awards bait movies, I think British biopics.
Fair. Also The Artist.
Or The Artist too. I mean even The Artist I feel like
was trying for something.
You know, The Artist, to me, didn't really feel like an awards baity movie. Or at least it wasn't made with that intention, I think. Because, I mean, it was from a French filmmaker. Nobody really expected The Artist to be a big thing. I think he just wanted to pay homage to silent films. And then it kind of became a big thing. Nobody has seen that movie since 2011 when it won Best Picture. But it's still sometimes the Oscars are hard to predict in that case. But when I think of awards bait, I think of, you know, occasionally Spielberg will fall into that. But, for the most part, I think it's, something like The King's Speech is probably a pretty good example of, it's based on a British king with a disability and like it's, and all that. And, you know, The King's Speech, I feel like plays a lot better than most awards bait Oscar type movies. But I'm getting a little off track. What I'm saying is The Post feels very exciting in a way that it might not seem on the surface of the movie. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah. I agree with that.
All right. So I think that about wraps up our discussion of The Post and a general discussion about the Oscars as well, apparently. Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I post our games at youtube.com/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog and all of our podcasts and stuff at filmbook.com. Thank you so much for listening to FilmBookCast. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike DiCriscio. If you're listening to this review via our podcast on iTunes, you can subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. Now, you can list the podcast you're emailing about in the title of your email. We would love to hear from you. Join us for the next episode of Film Bookcast, where I don't know exactly what we'll be doing. I'm not really sure what's coming out in the next 2 weeks. I'm thinking maybe just Phantom Thread. If you can see Phantom Thread, that would be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe we could do a dual kind of catch-up episode or something.
Maybe, yeah. We'll see what happens. You know, we could just do like a feature-length discussions episode. Who knows? Who knows what we can do?
It's our future, and we can write it whatever we want.
It's our podcast, and I'll die if I want to.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you can check out our next Complete Works, where we're talking Nicolas Cage's role in 2008's Bangkok Dangerous. Very excited.
Can't wait.
Very excited to see that one. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We are out. Charge it, gallopy goo, oh yeah. Clip, clap, a clip, clip, clap, a clip, clip, clap, the clue, oh yeah. Clip, clap, a war horse, baby, a war horse, baby, the boo, oh yeah now. Clip, clip, clap, war horse, baby, a war horse, baby, boo. A war horse, baby, war horse, baby, charge it, gallopy goo, oh yeah now. I love that. You guys hear that tune? You gotta learn that tune. I say, but won't ya? Oh, man, I love that. Yeah. I said a clip, a clomp, a clippity clomp. Dumbest thing we've ever done. And that's really saying something.
Yeah.
That's in the really dumb thing we've done Hall of Fame.
And that song is gonna stick in our brains for a long time.
Yeah.
I'll be driving
my wife,
home.
My wife is gonna be in the middle of the night. I'm gonna be like, a clamp, a clamp. Honey, wake up. I said, clamp, 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 clamp. Did it happen again?